That is correct.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Moments of Truth, the show about my favorite moments from my favorite things. I'm Bill Coffin, and today we'll be revisiting the topic of guilty pleasures, which we first covered in season 3 of this podcast, and which has since become one of our most popular episodes. So we decided to return to the scenes of our collective pop culture crimes and confess once more. Get ready for Guilty Pleasures 2, Electric Boogaloo. The idea of this podcast is to celebrate the things that we love and not to dunk on things, since there is an overabundance of mean-spiritedness out there, especially in pop culture commentary. So when we did our first Guilty Pleasures episode, a lot of the things that we talked about were things that we loved and that other people did too, but we personally experienced some blowback over. I had mentioned how much static I caught when I was a kid for listening to Styx or for reading the comic Power Pack. I was never really ashamed to like those things, though. I just never felt 100% safe admitting to them. Now, during the course of that episode, my co-host Chris mentioned at one point, quote, "I feel like you're trying to take the shame out of this, Bill." And he was right. Personally, I chose some really easy things to talk about, in part because I didn't want to slam things I felt were truly terrible, but also because I feared that if I really unburdened myself, I'd admit to being something far worse than a geek and a weirdo. I'd admit to having bad taste. Well, guess what? Nobody's got 100% good taste, and there's nothing wrong with owning that. So here we are again to revel in the wretched and to talk up the terrible. Let's do this before I lose my courage. With me today is Rule 34 researcher Chris Crenshaw.
Everything, people.
No exceptions. Strip club etiquette stickler Tom Hespos.
If you give a hooker cocaine... No, not doing it.
Revolutionary song and dance man, Joe Pace.
Guilty as charged.
And ninja sex master, Chris Swan.
One does not achieve it, one discovers it.
I'm so afraid now.
Yeah, that's not right.
That should be good.
Meet us. See us again next year for Guilty Pleasures 3, Mistakes Were Made. Anyway.
Bodies were buried.
Bodies were buried.
Divorces right. were obtained.
Seriously. all right, here's what we're gonna do. We're gonna roll for initiative to determine the order in which everybody speaks here. So Tom goes first, Joe goes second, Mr. Crenshaw third, Mr. Swan fourth, and I'll go fifth. Round one, we're gonna start with watch movies that are wonderful guilty pleasures. Tom Hespos, please introduce us to this new round of guilty pleasures. What is the movie you've picked? Why is it a guilty pleasure, and why is it still on your radar?
I really win with a 14. Like, there aren't monsters that need to go before me.
Dude, you play D&D with me long enough to know that if I'm rolling initiative, everybody gets low. Okay, so.
All the monsters are coming.
Oh,
okay. I wish I could do better for you. I just can't.
So the watch movie category. I'm going to throw out a documentary that I have no business liking because it is the exact opposite of a movie that I should like. First, I'll describe where it came from. Everybody has seen, I am sure, the old back in the day YouTube video of that dude's bulldozer that just sort of plows through a town and rolls over a bunch of cars. And I think everybody's seen this video. Well, it turns out they made a documentary of it. And that is my guilty pleasure, which is the 2020 documentary Tread, which is basically the story of Killdozer. And I was like, I will watch this one afternoon just for fun and, you know, just to have some mindless entertainment. And wound up so intrigued, I didn't know what to do with myself. So it turns out... The guy who, you know, there's a guy who basically got very frustrated with a lot of the people in his town over a property deal gone bad. And he poured something like 30 tons of concrete into this old bulldozer he had laying around, fixed it up with cameras and little slits he could fire a 50 caliber rifle through. And like, this is basically like, you know, the right winger doomer's wet dream, which is I can't understand why I love this thing. But like, they talk in this documentary about this guy going down this evil path of wanting to destroy his entire town. and I'm riveted.
Auto-duel style.
I'm listening to all his religious ravings and getting into them because this guy's like, God wants me to not get caught for this. And like, he's got all religious reasons for destroying his town. And at the end, I'm still rooting for him to destroy the entire town.
It's basically like when the Ghostbusters select the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man. It's like somebody said, what if a bulldozer came? And the destroyer.
I mean, he's clearly an underdog. The poor guy's you're like not wrong.
Underdog in a whole town of underdog.
Underdozer.
When you get to the end of the documentary, you kind of wish like somebody had just bombed the community at large, and
they all should go.
Yeah, happened, like, there is nothing wrong with this town.
No villain ever. It is the underdozer.
But I love a documentary about a guy who goes crazy and levels his town with a bulldozer.
So Tom, I have to ask, how serious was the documentary? Was this like a Behind the Music documentary, or was this like 60 Minutes? Like, what was the level of
Joe? It's objectively a bad documentary.
Okay. That's better.
That's true.
A crazy story, but it's a bad documentary, and
it's a bad story told badly.
Yes.
That's Tommy Wiseau from The Room directed this documentary.
I think these documentary crew didn't realize they didn't have enough story there to fully flesh this out the way they wanted to, right? The town probably did deserve to get run over by a bulldozer because everybody who's in a position of power there is just a freaking knucklehead.
I just want to hear that an HOA had something to do with it.
No, but like pretty close though. It was like, you know, the business, like the Chamber of Commerce and
close second.
That guy who hates me is in charge of the Chamber of Commerce, and you know, everybody's out to get me.
The instigating incident to this whole sad and tragic story is a mandatory sewer line hookup, right? That's this whole.
Which, I mean, actually, having dealt with
pettiness over the stupid stuff they are fighting over,
and it
makes me actually feel sorry for the man now. Too.
It's produced by a company called Gravitas Ventures, which is just about as awful as it sounds.
This is the VH1 Behind the Music of Hanson.
But I love it. I just love it.
Exactly. You can't get M-Pop out of your head.
I don't love Hanson, for the record.
So Tom, how often have you watched this movie?
It's like I only recently discovered it, but I've watched it like five times.
Oh my god, really? Five times.
I told you, Bill, when I discovered it, and I was like, you have to watch this.
Yeah, but I thought you'd seen it like twice.
No. I watched it again.
Those five times were in a row, too. Yeah.
Dude, you're like you watched this like two more times.
Well,
you're
I was trying to identify
territory.
The point at which like I thought. Yeah, this guy's like really off the rails because like there's a period there where you're just like, oh, this is just one of those, you know, business
this could be reasonable.
The voluntary dive down the rabbit hole.
Yeah. So the last three watches were forensic viewings, is what you're saying, right?
I know, but
okay, all right. Yeah.
That was the excuse.
No, the camera work is shaky, but if you watch for a little bit, suddenly it turns into like Eisenstein. Just watch. No, this is a 10-second clip.
No, seriously. If you auto stabilize it,
film critic. I love that.
You need an auto stabilization in place. Yeah,
but Tom, I agree with you. It is an objectively poor documentary. It's just like, it's just some things require a 10 minute news spot, and some things require a documentary. This required a 10 minute news spot. That was really
I kind of want to go back though and like raise money and get them like another $2 million.
Oh, God. No, I mean, that documentary has got to be made by the Comedy Central people.
Yeah, seriously,
from Daily Show. Those are the natural people to make that documentary.
I think we should move on because if this discussion makes me watch a sixth time, I'm going to feel complicit. I don't want to further a problem here. So, all right, Joe, what have you got for your guilty pleasure movie watching?
I'm going to take us from the ridiculous to sublime. And for me, a movie that I've probably seen a dozen times and have caught no end of flack for, the cinematic taping of the Broadway show 1776. A Broadway show that was done in the late 60s, early 70s by Stoner and Edwards, dramatic treatment of the signing of the Declaration of Independence, complete with song and dance. And if you haven't seen it, you're missing out because it's fantastic. It's got William Daniels, of the teacher from Boy Meets World, I guess, is how most people may know him. But he's John Adams. Ron Howard from The White Shadow as Thomas Jefferson.
The White Shadow? Wait a minute. Get the f*** out of here. Are you going to drop The White Shadow in the show? Stop it. Come on. The White Shadow?
It's Ron Howard.
The White Shadow?
Not Ron Howard. I'm sorry. That's not the name. It's...
I was like, that. I think
that's not Ron Howard. It's still The White Shadow.
A guy that played the White Shadow.
Yeah, whoever that dude
is. I know exactly what you mean. But
yeah.
He's Thomas Jefferson. Anyway.
IMDb says 1 minute.
Yeah, what do we got, yeah. Chris? Help me out.
I got to find it. Hold on a minute.
Yeah. Take. It might take a bit.
Remember The White Shadow.
Well, I wish I didn't. You know, Joe, I will give you some respect while we're waiting.
Ken Howard. Thank you very much.
There are a lot of things to be ashamed of here. I'm impressed.
We haven't even let him finish getting... Yeah, he hasn't gotten through it yet. We just kind of cut him off.
He's listed two people who are in the movie so far, I think.
Yeah, I mean, this is a talented cast. It was a Tony Award-winning Broadway show, and they did a movie. And this is basically there's singing, there's dancing, there's politics, there's the discussion of slavery. They handle a lot of very heavy stuff. This is the intersection of two of my great loves, which is American history and musical theater. And listen, people go watch Hamilton. They don't understand that Hamilton is the 2.0 version of this. Like, this is sui generis, like 1770. If there hadn't been 1776, I have the script for this, by the way.
It was called 1776 on Broadway.
Yes. And there was a revival
on Broadway.
Oh, big time in the early 70s.
Like, it wasn't like off a little bit.
No.
The 70s was a decade, off, man.
Off Broadway.
No,
we're not talking hair here.
No, there was a revival done in the mid 90s. Brent Spiner had the John Adams role. I love the movie. I've shown this to classes before. I've taught this movie as part of. They did this thing where they they used dialogue from the letters and diaries of the protagonists. It's a wonderful weaving together of history and of art. And I love it. I've caught no end of flack for 30 years for loving this. And so it seemed to me the perfect thing, the perfect installment for a guilty pleasure.
I don't think we're going to stop that streak here, Joe. Just
oh no, DiMaggio is alive.
I don't think I've seen Brent Spiner outside of a sci-fi context, but I feel like I might have picked a different John Adams there.
He was very good.
I saw Mark Singer play Petruchio in Taming the Shrew. So I'm a bad judge of character.
All things are possible.
there's a
master himself.
there's a song in this when Rutledge from South Carolina gets up to defend slavery, and it's called Molasses to Rum to Slaves. And it is, I can't describe it. If you haven't seen it, you have to see it, and you have to you power through some of the goofiness of it. By the way, Jefferson's wife is played by Blythe Danner, Gwyneth Paltrow's mom.
You have to hear the song about slavery though. Yeah.
Yeah,
this isn't Breitbart, dude.
it's from the perspective of South Carolina, okay? Like, of course they're going to defend it.
Yeah.
So
it was in their article. It was in their causes for secession document. So,
look. All things aside, I mean, the reaction you're getting from us is, I would say, would be fairly quizzical, but not exactly, hostile. What is the worst thing you've heard told to you as you are sharing this beloved film to people, and people are lining up and they're really letting you have it? Like, what's the worst thing that you've received having tried to champion this movie?
You've shown this to teenagers, right?
Oh yeah. I showed this.
Eighth graders?
Eighth grade. I taught this to my eighth grade class. And here's the thing.
You live dangerously. Sure.
Each of them had a colony that they were responsible for. And I made them write out tweets or Facebook posts at the end of each class about the perspective of their character that they just watched, and they had a ball with it. So, you know, pound sand, pal. Like, you know, my pedagogical talents are not part of this conversation.
Joe,
but I will say,
Joe,
that
wait a minute, stop. Wait, Joe, wait, stop. If you're telling me with a straight face, and you are in fact telling me with a straight face, that you dropped this movie on a class load of eighth graders, and not only did they not pants you to heaven and back for it, but they in fact wrote complimentary social media posts about it, then you either had the world's nicest class of eighth graders, or you are supernaturally gifted at teaching. Because I don't believe for a second there wasn't at least three eighth graders in there who were thinking diabolical thoughts about you because
they know your dad's
movie.
A cop.
Yeah, right there. That
hey, we're talking
social media. There it is. So this was relatively recent. This wasn't
2011.
2011, dude. How did they not kill you for this? They should be dragging you on social media
good.
Right now.
I will
I'm
say
just
this.
That good.
I will say this. The worst thing that was ever told to me about this was my first wife, who will appear again in this podcast. is she said, "You've taken something incredibly boring and added music to it." And I said, "Welcome to our marriage."
All right, fair enough. Mr. Crenshaw, what guilty pleasure from cinema do you have to share with us today?
All right, look, I'm gonna pull some ninjutsu of my own, because honestly, what I admitted to loving last time was just it really was the bottom of the barrel. Kung Pao, if you don't recall, I mean that is just a
when you
just
find
terrible,
rock bottom, keep digging.
Terrible
go.
Movie. I like what? How am I going to beat that? So let me pull in pay-per-view.
Yeah, sure. Okay.
And admit that I have had not one but two professional wrestling phases in my life.
Oh, this is what we came here for. Dish.
True story. So yeah, when I was a kid, 9-11 years old, it was I don't know, East Coast wrestling, I think. It was before the WWF, when they had all the small regional federations. Yeah. And people would move between them. So like we had Ric Flair for a while, and Ricky the Dragon Steamboat.
Woo!
Jimmy Snuka.
Superfly.
Yeah, man.
Turnbuckle. Yeah.
Boogie Woogie Man. So you know, I loved that stuff when I was a kid. I did. Ate it right up. But then when I was in college, like we kind of had a revival, you know. This was back, you know, like WrestleMania 1, 2, 3, that kind of,
yeah,
you know, back when, you know, we're talking like
Chic,
you know, yes. Hulk Hogan and
late stage Iron Hogan, Hulk Hogan, Ultimate Warrior was still a thing back then.
I mean, the guys in my fraternity, they just started getting into it, and I got sucked right in. I mean, that maybe not as bad as it could have been, I guess. But yeah, we paid for that. We paid for WrestleMania on the 3.5-foot projection screen in the basement. And you know, we talked about it some when it wasn't on even. And that's where the shame is.
Yeah. Okay. So, you're also using human shields here, because you're hiding behind the collective shame of your fraternity, which we can all do. What I need to know is from you, Chris, is A, who was your favorite wrestler from that era? There is one you would have killed for. Now, who was it?
Ricky the Dragon Steamboat was my all-time favorite.
Oh, he was
no
pretty
doubt
badass. Ricky the Dragon Steamboat was pretty
Dreamboat
great.
Steamboat.
He was fantastic, man. Absolutely,
he was the man.
Now, Chris, the other question I have for you is, what WWE storyline had you like flipping the table over? You're like, this is bullcrap. This is injustice. I can't believe it. And got you the closest to acting as if this was actually for real.
No, that never happened. That I ate it all up. Like, yeah, that's the best. Then do that.
Okay, all right.
But my favorite was like the whole like Undertaker Paul Bearer storyline, where you know, like Paul Bear turns on him and stuff. It was the best. It was so funny.
Have you ever gone to a wrestling show live?
No, I never have. It's kind of a regret.
I'm gonna join you on the hill, Mr. Crenshaw.
My dad
took me April 7th, 1986, and I don't even have to look that up. WrestleMania 2.
Dude.
That's a
and
big
I
deal.
Loved it.
Yeah.
Yeah. How could you not?
No, absolutely. I have on my bucket list you know, and one of my items on the on my bucket list is to attend a monster truck rally at some point. But right below that is to attend a wrestling match, like an actual like live like professional wrestling match, which I never have done. I would, you know, yeah, it would. I would love to do that. I especially would love to check out like luchadors, man. That would be like
that'd be fun.
That'd be pretty fun. That's where it transcends and gets to like,
yeah,
you know,
it's not just kayfabe; it's art.
It's cultural significance. Yeah, it's like actual heritage. Yeah, it's it's good stuff. Chris, what would you be willing to go back and to pay cold hard adult money now to rent a professional wrestling match?
Oh God, yeah. Like, well, if I could go back, like in time,
and watch some of them,
no hesitation at all.
Yeah. If I could go back and see the Undertaker claiming the belt for the first time, or no, better yet, Andre the Giant and Hulk Hogan. Oh yeah, oh, I'd do that in a heartbeat. Right,
yeah. Oh yeah, right.
Like, that's like generational stuff. That's like Miracle on Ice. only not really a miracle.
I didn't see that coming. I'm looking through my pictures because when Sarah was deployed to Afghanistan, Vince McMahon came and visited her base.
Awesome.
And there's a picture of her with Vince McMahon. And it's like one of my all-time favorite pictures because she's like, I have no clue who this guy is. And why is everyone having their picture taken with this like doddering old lick? Like, what is happening right now?
Fantastic.
But she has a picture that she sent to me. And I was like, oh, they're running out of talent. Like, they've got to go.
You should as a gift, you should like, you know, Photoshop her part of that picture onto the meme. You know?
Yeah. I can't find it. It's bumming me out. He's like,
my favorite Vince McMahon moment of all time wasn't even in the WWE. He was actually he was on an interview with it was like Bob Costas, right? And he was going after him for like basically the increasingly just racy content of the WWE, and you know basically like, you know, you're showing stuff like, and kids are watching this, and you know, how do you justify the content of your show? And he gets like all salty about it. And he goes, well, wait a minute. You work for HBO. And Costas is like, yes, I do. He goes, well, number one show is The Sopranos, right? Well, why is it okay for you to get away with, you know, in that episode, in every episode of that show, you say the word all the time. And he didn't say the F word. He said the word, right? Just looking at him, like trying to hold something together. Like, he's like, you're right.
That's a fair criticism, sir.
This is exactly the episode where we get an explicit badge. Just for the record.
Yeah, I just get this one an explicit badge. Yeah,
I'll tell you though.
So funny. It was so funny.
You really do make a good point, Bill. Sort of indirectly. I think the one I'd pay the most to go back to see was when Donald Trump came on stage or into the ring. I would like to see
opportunity.
That would be. It would have been cool to have been there.
Yeah, exactly. Oh no! Hey, Zach Calhoun on the top turnbuckle. He's gonna kill him.
Guy came with a chair and broke his neck.
Yeah,
a shame.
For shame, I don't know. Anyway,
Elizabeth Warren off the top rope.
Yeah. Exactly. We'll see you back in the primary.
That's Bernie Sanders music.
Oh man, it's good stuff. All right, Mr. Swan, what have you brought with us? What have you brought to this conversation from the annals of shameful cinema?
The past 3 minutes, I have been frantically looking through IMDb because I'm like, I am not at the correct level.
Oh, yeah, it takes some calibration.
Up or down. So I'm like,
just shut up and pass.
Throw this out. The 80s were a special time.
That is true.
It was a different time.
It was a very different era. Although it's funny because all of my seniors at homecoming, they dress up like people did in the 80s, like there's a decades day. And that I was in like, outside of music videos, no one dressed like that, but okay. We were not all like in multicolored spandex. And so, anyway, not in public anyway. So, there were movies like Top Gun that were huge, you know, bombastic, cinematic, glorious sort of patriotic. I mean, look at the remake of it recently, which was actually pretty good.
There was that film about Bill defeating the Soviet Union at Spy Hunter.
Yeah,
remember that one?
Yeah, that's a good one.
So good it had no sequel. Continue.
And then you had actors like R.I.P. Patrick Swayze,
who
are you gonna do Roadhouse? Because I'm here for it.
Yeah, I'm doing Roadhouse.
Yeah. Yes! So, that's a guilty pleasure.
Oh,
right there.
Yes.
Yeah, for sure.
You can't not
throat rip.
Turn it. It was on TBS for, I think it was they were contractually obligated for a period somewhere in the mid 90s just to run it like at least once a week
and twice a day
between Office Space and Shawshank.
I was on my break.
Yeah, see, Shawshank gave them like, okay, they gave him some sort of credibility. This is a work of art. By the way, Roadhouse, which so Patrick Swayze plays Dalton, who is not a bouncer. He is a cooler, which in the opening 5 minutes of the movie, he explains the difference to some one kid who wants to get in. You are the bouncers. I am the cooler. And it's both ridiculous. And you're also like, that guy's cool as hell. He gets hired away from the big city by this guy, Jimmy, who for reasons unknown and perhaps inexplicable, that doesn't really matter, wants to open a roadhouse in the middle of absolutely freaking nowhere. And he's convinced it's going to do well. It's apparently so good that he has gained the enmity of Ben Gazzara's character, Brad Wesley, who doesn't want something competing in his neighborhood. The plot doesn't matter. There's Patrick Swayze is going to basically somehow, as the head cooler, the guy who runs the bouncer, is going to clean this place up and make it work. It is the concept's poor. The writing is questionable, and you cannot stop watching it because
it's
Swayze,
ridiculous, Chris.
Swayze, like, for all of his acting, Swayze had such charisma.
Yeah.
The fact that he took his shirt off every 30 seconds probably didn't hurt him with certain demographics.
He had a shirt?
Yeah. and the he plays this stoic but philosophical,
Zen. Right? That is a lot of Tai Chi.
Zen Buddhist dude, like he gets caught. Right.
I don't like conflict. Blast. But I'll rip your throat out. It's okay.
Right. Yeah, I did that once. That will never happen again. You're like, and when will it happen again?
Let's wait.
Oh,
he has to go. He has to go right to the doc to get stitched up. Yeah, and she's like, "I'll give you a shot." He's like, "There will be no pain."
No,
pain and he delivers this line complete.
That's right.
And he has his arm up, and he's talking. She staples him, and he goes, right? Like that would be me, maybe like stubbing my toe against a Nerf ball, right? And he's like, he's just gotten a
Nerf ball.
We're in staple. Just
pain don't hurt.
That doesn't hurt, you know.
Oh God!
What are you all here for? Have a good time. Start a fake grabs and goes, "You're too stupid to have a good time." The whole thing is full of lines like that.
Exactly. No, your problem is Swan. You're a bleeder.
It has some of the most awkward sexual chemistry between the hot doc Kelly Lynch, and they kiss each other and they make these grimaces. Like they're supposed to be overcome with passion. They look like they're experiencing hernias.
Yeah,
and the bad guy really, like watching really from hurts. His house across the more like, I can't believe he's kissing hot doc. I'm going to send my killer to bro. Inexplicably, for what Sam Elliott strolls in the middle of the movie,
who was already
steals every scene he's in.
Absolutely,
because he's basically the Uber or cooler,
right?
Whom Dalton like
he's,
trained
he's Obi-Wan
under.
Bouncer.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. He's Obi-Wan bouncer
with the Phoenix Force.
Yeah. And he's got like a gimp leg, and it doesn't matter because he can still beat the hell anybody. In the meantime,
his
Jeff Healey band just keeps playing in the background, like all through the movie. Doesn't matter. There's sawdust flying, blood spurting through the air. They must have
beer bottles smashing on the chicken wire. Yeah.
Yeah.
Chicken wire.
Like chicken wire can smash a beer bottle.
Yeah, from the Blues Brothers,
and Western.
Okay,
it is an utterly ridiculous movie that is completely pleasurable to watch, and I'm not really sure why. It's probably because Patrick Swayze is just goes for it and plays it fairly seriously with just enough level. Like you kind of know he knows that this is campy as hell, but
It's just hysterically funny.
It's not just him though. I think what makes that movie hold together is that everybody commits to the bit, right? Like, and it's not so serious that it's begging to have the air taken out of it. Like they kind of, everybody hits the sweet spot from the main characters to the small characters, and it's on like remarkably consistent wavelength. And yeah, it holds together way better than it has any right to, because it is a super dumb fun.
Plus, I've always wanted to rip a throat out like that.
Right. Who hasn't? Right? Exactly. So, oh, they call that the New Hampshire handshake, don't they, Joe?
We don't shake hands.
Or bleed. Exactly.
We just bleed.
So, it all just freezes on the snow.
Yeah. No, Roadhouse is like, that movie isn't like a special little place in film Valhalla. It is just like, it's one of the all-time greatest bad movies. It really, really is. Yeah. And you know,
they're remaking it.
Did you know
that, or did you just look that up?
No, I saw like something about it recently. I wish it were April. You know, I wish I could.
You know, it would be cool though, is if they remade that in Ghost at the same time, right? And so you had like
Whoopi Goldberg's throat out.
Well, it just had Patrick Swayze's apparition teaching whoever's going to take over for him, right? That would be just, I don't know. I think that'd be kind of cool.
Would you look at this mullet? My God, this is like...
Are we doing pottery?
Oh, his hair is mad.
He has to make the vessel from
like,
which
how are you going to redo that? Like,
yeah, no, seriously?
You can't. That's what I'm saying. Yeah. It is of a time.
That's like, who's got the bigger hair?
Like, I mentioned Top Gun earlier. Like, you can't. I was like, how are they going to remake Top Gun? I'm like, that's
they
fine.
Did it.
Because Tom Cruise is a vampire and he doesn't age. That's fine. But it's basically the same movie.
I'm ready to be a Scientologist just based on the fact.
And it was a hell. That was a hell of a lot of fun. But
it was.
That's got a lot of quality. Like, Roadhouse does not. Cinematography, it's something like point camera here. I mean,
Chris, Roadhouse, to me, Roadhouse and Rocky IV. You know what I mean? Like, you're talking like there's this specific level of movie that could only be made like in 1987 or whatever. You know what I mean? Like,
there's
a very, very
late
80s, narrow window.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
Dude, it's in 1989 that movie was made. That's embarrassingly late to have a
movie. It is late. That is a late entry into the.
But he still pulled it off. I mean, that's just.
There's like a 3-year window. Yeah. See, but there's like, see, that movie is at the beginning of this like 2 or 3 year window when you had 80 styles movies that were still in the Hollywood pipeline.
Oh, but Tango and Cash, Bill.
But they benefited from the early 90s gloss. So they had this like this higher level of treatment they really deserved, you know?
So you're saying that the peak for 80s movies was actually like 1991?
Like Under Siege?
I completely agree. Yes. 1991. Yes, Under Siege. Don't diss Under Siege. Oh my goodness gracious.
Speaking of guilty pleasures, can we all just agree? Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah. I had a big existential discussion of, am I going to bring Steven Seagal in this episode or am I not? You know,
because
no, he's a bloated traitor. End
I don't
story.
Have
there
three
we go.
Words to use.
Yeah, exactly. So,
Swayze could act and dance and pretend to do martial arts.
Yeah, exactly.
But let's all agree that Patrick Swayze's best moment ever on film was next to Chris Farley on that SNL skit with the Chippendales. Like, I'm sorry. Like,
yeah.
Well, you know what? As,
oh my God.
Well, but what makes that such a great bit though is kind of what makes Roadhouse such a great bad action movie, which is that he sells it. He's very earnest. Like he's a very earnest kind of actor.
He's basically Graham Chapman in Monty Python and the Holy Grail.
Yeah, like he's really fully committed. And so like Roadhouse made me wish he had done more action movies. So I was like, you know what? At that time, like the kind of action movies we were getting, you know, I mean, like he was great in Point Break, right? And you know, it was
Swayze made Keanu.
You know, he was even great in Next to Kin, which is not a particularly good movie.
I was going to say, watch Roadhouse, then go watch Next to Kin, and then you'll laugh. If you don't laugh at Roadhouse, you'll laugh at Next.
You know, but it made me wish he had done more action movies because I was like, you know what, this is actually like, I don't know, I felt like I was eating my vegetables while I was watching.
I had the time of my life.
Very nice.
I wondered if that was coming up.
Yeah, of course.
Well played, Pace. Well played.
Mr. Swan, I sure appreciate your selection because it segues beautifully into mine. Because yes, the 80s were a special time. They were a very special time. And 1987 was a special time within a special time. Because in that year, it gave us The Lost Boys. It gave us RoboCop. Mm-hmm. It gave us Predator. It gave us The Princess Bride. It gave us Full Metal Jacket. And it also gave us Man Killers, which is far and away the worst movie I've ever seen.
I thought you were far away the best of the bus.
No.
Where this is going, Bill?
No. Man Killers is honest to God. It is the reigning champion for the worst movie I've ever seen, and I've seen some really. It comes straight from the heart of the Derek Eisenhart video catalog, right? So, Derek, our editor, has also got extraordinarily questionable taste in movies, mainly because, like a tiger shark, he'll eat anything, and that includes movies. And so, and he'll just watch any movie as if he doesn't actually live in finite time like the rest of us. And he was like, "Bill, you got to watch this movie." I'm like, "I don't have to watch anything you tell me to watch." He goes, "No, really, you have to watch this movie." And I'm like, "Well, okay, fine. Like, where am I going to find it?" It's like, "Oh, I don't know." So turns out it was on YouTube, because you know what? It is so bad. It falls in that category of movies that are openly being pirated on YouTube, and nobody's going to bother to stop it.
Right? Like, nobody wants to admit owning it.
Exactly. Just take it, man. Just take
it. Does anybody have the copyright to this? No one exactly. cares.
Well,
no,
that's the thing. Don't. I mean, I would not be surprised if somebody forgot to file a paperwork on this movie. I mean, it is that bad. And it's not just terrible acting and terrible effects and terrible shooting and terrible and all that stuff, right? There's
terrible writing, there's
a million movies that have got 0% skill level attached to it, right? But they at least try or believe in what they're trying to do. This movie's also like extraordinarily half-assed. It's clear they're not even trying hard and have no intention to try hard, right? This is like if a group project in school didn't have the smart kid to carry it. Okay, it's that kind of a movie. It's really, really awful.
It doesn't even believe in its own premise. Why?
No, it really doesn't. So this movie is so bad that MST3K would never do an episode on it, because for them it would be punching down. Okay, like that's how bad this
wow.
movie is. Okay, yeah. And Man Killer.
That's just mean, Bill.
That's
what do you
mean? That comment was a documentary. Okay, I'm not being mean there. I'm just spitting facts.
I gotta ask, what is it that you love about it though?
What I love about it is true and ferocious. Before I get to it, let me just set the stage. So the IMDb summation for this movie is: a female CIA agent is assigned to train and lead an all-female squad to Colombia to stop a renegade agent who has hired himself out to a drug cartel. Okay.
Very AIDS.
The keywords on IMDb. The IMDb keywords that'll help you find this movie in the sea of movies that are already there include: female commando, independent film, girls with guns, female CIA agent, and then nipples visible through clothing. Right. There is, okay.
That's a key
further
word,
support
say.
For the Apple sensors.
Right, seriously.
I don't write the keywords, people.
This movie is not. What I love about this movie is when this movie fails even by its own standards, it's awesome. And so there are two scenes that I'll call out. One is, and by the way, just look up Man Killers, one word, 1987 on YouTube. It's right there. Nobody's trying to hide it. And jump to about the 8-minute mark, where there's a scene of this, you know, drug deal gone wrong. That's just completely terrible. Has the most half-assed shootout in the world. And then is followed by, like, it's not even half-assed. It's like a quarter-assed car chase scene. Okay, where the one car they jump into is clearly missing its headlights. Like, they obviously got this junker from some lot, or they stole it, so they couldn't even bring it up to, like, it's not even street legal, this car. Right?
There's no plates at all.
Nothing, right? This car is like barely held together. They're driving. The chase is literally happening at about 20 miles an hour. Like, it is so slow. They just can't, they'd have no stunt driving. So they're just like driving. Obviously, so the camera guy doesn't fall out of the car. It's really, really bad. But then the best part is when you go all the way to the end of the movie, the final shootout is just like, it's just, you know, it's just like, I just want you to think of every, like, really, and not Roadhouse bad. I mean, like, truly bad. Okay. Roadhouse is kind of beautiful in its way. I mean, like, really, like, Joe Bob Briggs.
We,
like,
are generous, like, people. Right,
you know, type stuff. Chris just put Patrick Swayze up on the thing. It's so great.
I don't see a difference.
Honestly, like brothers.
Maybe a little more hair on Chris.
Maybe.
It's a sweet mullet, Chris. That's all I got to say.
But the end of Man Killers, there's this final shootout where the lead female commando gets this rocket launcher.
The lead
and a
female
gun.
Commando. All right, keep
right.
going.
And she goes running in.
That was her character's name.
That probably, yes.
Lead female commando.
Lead female commando number one.
Number
right?
one.
And then there's like Booty Shorts Commando number 2, and then there's like No Bra Commando number 3, and it's just like all that sort of stuff, right? But like, she was in chasing after the final bad guy, and there's like 3 different moments where like she shoots him fatally, right? It's like blam, and he goes, ugh, and this like weak, like Donald Trump little expulsion of air, ugh, right? He just sounds so stupid, and he falls down and crawls around, and then like he gets back up again, and they have like another death scene. They have like 4 death scenes on this guy, and each one is more
Paul Rubens from Buffy.
Yes, it's kind of like that, but done seriously. And the best part is he finally gets in a car and he shoots the car with his rocket launcher, right? And they don't have the budget to actually blow up a car. So the car is, say, it just cuts this car to stop their parked, and this little smoke bomb goes off in the middle of the car, and you hear this final, it just walks up to the rest of the commando squad, goes, all right, let's go home. And just cuts to credits. Like, it is so absolutely horrible. But it's not just that's funny on its own, because it very much is. It also, like, for me, it distills like every single really awful direct-to-video movie I ever saw in the 80s, like from like that I rented from gas stations, that, you know, it just all that sort of stuff, like the stuff that was that blockbuster after like every other movie was rented, you know, like all that kind of really horrible stuff, you know, the Joe Bob Briggs drive-in theater kind of stuff, you know. It kind of distills the worst parts of all of them into one.
Elvira, Queen of the Dark.
Yeah, that kind of, it was all so bad. You know what? I am weirdly grateful to Derek for putting it on my radar, because it's really funny and really terrible, and I will see it again, I have no doubt. But it is easily the worst movie ever made. And I will. That's it. That's it. Probably will die.
You know, once you started flagellating yourself, why would you stop?
when I was in high school, we used to watch USA Up All Night, like Silk Stockings and all that kind of stuff, and they were the worst movies, and you watch them like because maybe there would be some girl, you know, slightly in deshabille and some regrettable dialogue. And I remember this one movie we watched, I don't even remember the name of it, but there was this, I think it was Alice Cooper was in it, and he was in this jacuzzi, and there was this big like snake in the jacuzzi.
Checks out.
What's that?
That's a checks out.
Checks out.
Yeah, right. And then at one point he was like, okay, we're gonna go to this other place and do this thing. And he's like talking to his followers, and he goes, oh, and there's a snake in the jacuzzi. Bring that too. And for my buddies and I, for like years, that was the go-to line for if we were heading anywhere, like, oh yeah, yeah, bring the cooler and bring your bag, and there's a snake in the jacuzzi, bring that too. And it became shorthand for these horrible like sexploitation, like idiotic movies. And I cherish the fact that you have one that means a lot to you.
Oh, that's
good. You know, well, I think you dream this, because IMDb keywords Alice Cooper jacuzzi do not result in anything.
Hey, listen, headcanon is
no Alice stronger than denied. IMDb.
Headcanon is powerful.
Outstanding. All right, moving on to round 2. Guilty pleasures from television. All right, Tom, what is your TV-based guilty pleasure? This is going to be good.
All right, so back in the 80s, I read a newspaper column, Cecil Adams and the Straight Dope. I don't know if any of you guys are fans, but he was like, he wrote a column for the Chicago Reader that was like, it was kind of like Ask Marilyn, except he had personality. So it was like, you know, write in and ask questions of the world's smartest human being. Anyway, somebody had asked about, you know, this island that had pirate treasure buried on it.
Oh, no.
And I read this column and I was like, there's an island out there that like people think have pirate treasure on it and they still haven't found it. Just, you know, fast forward a decade or two, and we wind up with everybody's favorite cable show, The Curse of Oak Island, which is a wonderful guilty pleasure of mine. It is narrated by the same guy who narrates Ancient Aliens and has the exact same cadence and same thing that he does in both shows, which is, you know, call out the thing that's supposed to be the surprising that's not surprising at all. These guys are just on this island excavating for buried treasure. It's been going on for 10 seasons, and I still feel like the next episode is going to be the one where they find the treasure.
anytime now I'm due.
And it's like, you know that they're trolling you. You know that they're just stretching this out so they can cover the budget for, you know.
This is what, season 10 or 11? Like, it's been going on forever.
For real, like, I have seen some of this show, and it kind of impinges on my own choice. But, I can't imagine stopping. What caught you? What caught you? Like, it's everything I've seen is so boring.
But I'm sitting there riveted.
It's like watching Geraldo doing Al Capone's vault for 11 years.
Just think, yeah.
It's like team. Yeah. Even he figured
we're gonna dig over there tomorrow.
It's like, well, we gotta wrap this up.
And they'll find like an old rusty nail, and then the narrator will step in and it'll be a nail.
We brought it back to the lab.
You're the last place where they uncovered a bunch of old crap, and you're like, yeah, there's gonna be gold coins right under that. I swear it's happening.
This speaks to the metal detector in you, which I value. I will say this. I had never heard of this show. Okay, but this spring, my uncle, my father's younger brother, got sick, stomach cancer. And we said goodbye to him a couple of months ago. Among his last words to his girlfriend were, "I'm never gonna know what happens on Oak Island." Well, I shit you not.
Kill. That guy died like he lived.
And I feel bad, not because he's never gonna find out, but because he watched that stuff.
Wow.
10 seasons of it. There were 25 episodes each of the last several seasons.
This guy watched it religiously on his deathbed on his iPad. He couldn't hold a cup and he was watching this garbage.
You know what? If he had been an elf from Rivendell and they made that show for 600 seasons, those would still be his same final words.
You know, though, if George Lucas had made this show, he would have like brought him on to set and they would have like ginned up a treasure discovery.
There's no Make-A-Wish for 70-ish ex-cops, okay?
Oh my gosh. That's
100% true, by the way. And that's when you started talking about, oh, there's this island. I'm like, I know exactly where this is headed. And this is where Uncle David wasted his final days on this planet with this. And I knew exactly where we were headed with him.
Wow.
Oh my God.
Wow. That's, you know what? That's a letter you should write to the producers just to see how that lives in their head.
Thank you for wasting final days.
My uncle, as he died from cancer, regretted not knowing if you're ever going to find treasure or not. Please find something for season 12.
Just pretend. Yeah. Send him a made-up tape. Yeah. Don't even broadcast it.
Can you just spray paint like a silver dollar gold and send it his way, please? Oh, something.
God. I found it.
Hey, look, it's a Canadian toonie. Hey.
Toonie. Stop it.
Chris Crenshaw, what regrettable artifact have you brought to us from the realm of television?
You know, I travel for work a lot, and you know,
Canadian
when you're in hotel rooms, you
rent models.
You know, there's always a different cable system, right, from town to town, from hotel to hotel, and you know, you can generally count on around 40 channels. Over the last several years, the goddamn mystery of Oak Island one has been on 24/7. I can absolutely assure you, like, you can't get away from it. And like, it's one of the many shows, many, many cable shows I just skip past until I can find some Law and Order.
You're a nice
Law and Order is... Joe, you're a big West Wing fan. I would always choose Law and Order over West Wing, and I think it's simply because it's more prurient. I don't know.
That was a straight up murder attempt against Joe Pace. Damn. I hope you realize.
No.
Chris tried to use his guilty pleasure to punch down on Joe's. Like,
I am admitting the superiority of West Wing.
Like, yeah, like, it'll never show up on a guilty pleasures list.
That is at least that is a show. Like, whether I entirely buy it or not, it's trying to make a point. It's trying to tell a narrative, and you know. Order is just, you know, ripped from the headlines. You know, what can we do sensationally today to make your day more interesting? And you know, especially SVU, you know, has that whole like angle that has to make you a little bit uncomfortable because it's so popular. It's so popular, and it has everything to do with the prurience of it, as far as I can tell.
Yeah.
And so, like, I feel like
just the don't whole... you say anything bad about Mariska Hargitay. We're gonna have words, Crenshaw.
Hey, she has been committed to a job for a very long time.
Yes,
you have to respect that. And she looks almost exactly the same as when she started it. I mean,
that's what I'm saying. Yeah,
I don't.
That's a beautiful woman. I don't know. And a good actress. I don't know. I'm not entirely ashamed of it because it's decent television. It's a good television. It's, you know, for 48 minutes. Yeah. And
X-Files, if
it you was... know, you've got a few characters that you can love and or hate. Yeah. And Richard Belzer, for God's sake. Come on.
Yeah. Is that the one
with Ice-T? Silver Spoons? Ice-T.
That's Ricky from Silver Spoons, isn't it, right?
Ricky
from Silver Spoons was in one of the CSIs, I believe.
Ricky Schrader. It's the same shit.
Yeah, I think he was in one of the CSIs.
Well, how many spinoffs are there of
Law and Order? A lot, and most Law and Order. Of them.
Parking
most
tickets.
Of them, I'm fine with. But I don't think I've ever seen like Law and Order L.A. for example. That was one, wasn't it? And
yeah,
there are a bunch. But
Chris, you would enjoy. I don't know if you've seen it, but Northwood's Law. Have you watched any of these?
No,
Northwood's Law is fantastic.
Right, a lot of them are in New Hampshire. I know some of the guys that are the fish and game guys on there. It's basically Northwood's fish and game catches guys who are snowmobiling too fast.
So it's like Letterkenny cops.
Kind of. It's basically like it's basically like Law and Order. If you're fishing without a license, and we're going to check out your paperwork and we're going to go take you home to your mom.
I mean, you know, it doesn't have quite the same stakes as
there's a lot less tackling and there are no chalk drawings, you know,
an abducted 13 year old girl, but you know,
yeah, well, actually there is some of that, but they're married,
I suppose. But
I love how Joe changes the subject to not talk bad. About Chris's show. Like, hey, look,
does anybody else feel that?
I'm making fun
of great, Chris. What's the what, Joe? What show are you talking about? Right?
All I know about SVU is this. SVU got so mainstream that Sesame Street actually did a parody of it called Special Letters.
Yes,
Unit. They've got like a Richard Belzer look-alike Muppet, like, you know, talking on it. It's outstanding. It's so good.
The Muppets Game of Thrones thing is pretty good too.
Yeah, it is. So, Chris, my question to you is, Chris, your love of Law and Order, has it morphed into a love for CSI as well?
No, it has not. No, I've never been fond of CSI or really of almost any of the other shows in the genre. There was an exception called Murder One that was out near the beginning of the Law and Order run. That was, I thought, an exceptional show that should have gone further. But no, Law and Order, I'm an Alistair Reynolds fan, and he's got this idea of indoctrinal viruses, like a virus that can make you religious. It's kind of like that. I put my faith in Law and Order. Thank you.
Although, except Mark Harmon is the most likable.
I'm a Dapper Dan man.
In any of
okay.
them,
that's so Dapper Dan versus FOP. All right, right. So CSI is FOP. Okay.
Is there anybody on Law and Order more likable than Mark Harmon?
Is he on Law and Order? I thought
he's on CSI. That's my point.
No, he's on NCIS.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Oh, it's right.
I'm not sorry. They're all the same.
Something with a C and an I and an S.
Yeah, right. It's letters. It's like Scrabble dies. I don't know how to.
Chris, what is your stand? I mean, standalone. Honest to God, you must have a favorite episode of.
Someone
got murdered, and there was a
no, absolutely not, Bill. That's the point of the show. That is why I love it. I might have seen the episode 15 times. I won't really remember the end.
So the whole show is a fugue state, is what you're saying.
Yeah, and you know, you just enter Law and Order.
12:15.
It's there, and at 10:03 when WWE comes on, you're like, okay, I guess I can go to bed.
Okay, I've got a meeting in the morning and a Sam Waterston, I gotta go.
Right, that's Sam Waterston.
Sam Waterston is, yeah. He is the, I think, definitive Law and Order guy. Unless you count
I love him. Like, he's fantastic. So I'll allow that.
I love in that show too. When every time there's like a special guest star, you're like,
they're the
murderer, or they're the victim.
When Robin Williams shows up, you know.
He's killed 11 teenage girls.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. Joe, what is your guilty pleasure from television?
Oh, it's Law and Order. I'm sorry. What? It's my turn. Okay. I'm going to take this in a different direction from that. And I'm going to say that when Sarah was pregnant with Bobby, I'm going back now to, like, I think 2007, Blockbuster was still a thing. And we would go and rent movies and rent shows and watch them on the couch while she was, you know, in her confinement. And so we started watching the first season of How I Met Your Mother. And this is a show that for the first maybe two or three seasons was some of the funniest television I've ever seen. Laughed and we enjoyed it and we stuck with it. And this is a show that did not stick the landing, by the way. For much of it, it was one of these shows that Doogie Howser's Barney Stinson is one of the, funnier characters, one of the more original characters that we've seen on TV. And we watched it and we watched it and we watched it and we enjoyed it. And we
that's the show that made me stop thinking of him as Doogie Howser.
Right.
And I was like, you said that. I was like, oh yeah, he did that. And forever he was known for that.
Exactly. And
it was like Dr. Hatred or whatever, but okay.
No. What was that COVID one he did? It was Dr. Feelgood or what was it?
Dr. Horrible Sing Along. Yeah.
That was well before COVID.
Yeah. With Nathan Fillion as Captain Hammer. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's it.
So, but we watched this and it was to me, it was an example of a show that, like, there were two or three good seasons. And because of that, you stuck with the narrative for an extra, like, five or six seasons that you shouldn't have.
Like Friends.
No, the entirety of Friends is worth watching. But the, we watched, and then not long ago, like last year, we watched these with the kids, and they died. They love this show. There's so much physical humor and wordplay, and like, the writing really is really fun. And yet it's an example of a show where it doesn't age particularly well, and the ending of it is like seriously problematic. And so that's why I put it in the guilty pleasures category, because every time I see it, I think about how badly it ended, and it colors the entire experience for me.
Kind of amazing how many shows have, like, long running shows in particular, like episodic shows, that just have a really hard time sticking the landing. Like, it's so prevalent that we tend to remember the shows that really stick the landing, because we just sort of assume that they won't.
There's not that many.
I kind of wonder what it is about the nature of these shows, it's the format or what, that they just can't quite figure out how to make it end. Because it wasn't until, I mean, by my reckoning anyway, it wasn't until, like, relatively recent, like when we started getting a lot more, like, really high-end serialized television, whether it was on networks or on Netflix or whatever else, that, you know, shows were kind of written with an ending in mind. And so they kind of reached an ending in a natural, sensible way, and kind of made an ending that felt right. Before that, it's like you're always hearing about, like, oh yeah, St. Elsewhere had a horrible ending. Oh yeah, Cheers had a real, you know, just
Cheers,
real solid.
No, I'm sorry. Cheers was fine.
Not MASH, though.
MASH was fine. I think that some of the shows that were really successful, and it was, they kept getting renewed, and they outlived their premise and all these other sorts of things.
Your Cosby shows and
right, like, but they got to the point. But even, like, honestly, one could argue the Cosby Show, for all the problematic warts associated with the people involved,
there's a guilty pleasure,
did fine with how they ended. But, like, there were some that, like, if you know you're gonna, the cash cow is gonna keep getting milked year after year after year after year.
Yeah.
there's no need to plan out an ending because it's evergreen. Whereas now I think in the Netflix era, it's, this is a 5-show arc and we're gonna end it. Whereas I think some of the shows didn't have the option to go out on their own terms. Whereas I think the list of like Cheers, MASH, Seinfeld, Friends, whatever, like who went out when they're like, okay, we're going to stop it here and we can script our own ending, versus shows where they're like, oh, they found out with 4 shows left that you're not going to get renewed and they've got to hurry some ending. And so you get the,
Was that the case with How I Met Your Mother though? I mean, like, it seems like the whole notion is like the premise of the show is in the name of the show. So they need to eventually answer it. And I think I never actually watched the show, but my daughter saw it and she was similarly not happy with the ending and kind of felt like the whole ending was a bit of a bait and switch for people who watch the show the entire time.
Yeah, I mean, there's, for that one, the entire premise is a guy telling his kids about how he met their mother. And so you've got the video of the children. And when they filmed the first season, they also filmed the ending of him telling the kids how he met their mother and how the show ends. And 9 years later, they've got this in the can, and the creators were stubborn about, this is the ending that we want, even when the show and the characters and the writing took it in a completely different direction.
Oh,
and
I see.
So in the last 8th or 9th season or whatever it was, there was a hard left turn back to the pre-planned ending.
I see.
And it was an example of, from a creative standpoint, being like tied into the ending you had pre-planned versus letting the show evolve in a certain direction and changing the way it ended, which to me as a creative is instructive, because you know your characters will tell you things over time and you got to let them. You can't be hidebound to the ending you had planned if the characters tell you that that's not the right ending anymore.
Yeah.
Well, isn't the issue that the characters had changed too much? Like they allowed the characters to change too much to really let the ending work.
That's correct.
Like, because, yeah, you know, the characters are in fact in the control of the author, I believe. I'm in the presence of 3 actual.
Well, no, published authors. Yeah, but you know what, though? We write novels. We don't do television shows, right? And television and movies are extremely collaborative, right? And
yeah, so, the acting. I suspect that, you know, Neil Patrick Harris, for example, must have changed where that show went, because that character was so successful.
And he grew. And, you know, and I'm not going to get into it. There's a lot of blocking and tackling to get into here. But he grew to the point where in the last like 2 episodes, they undid like 2 seasons worth of character growth, and the fan base rebelled against that.
Yeah. And that's hard.
And basically the show ended with what would have been a satisfying ending to the first season, but was not satisfying after 9 seasons.
Got it. Okay.
And
they made their money.
Yeah. But it was also, it was an example, Chris, of where like, I think they found out midway through that season that they weren't going to have a 9th or 10th or whatever.
Yeah.
So like, they felt they needed one more year to get where they wanted to go.
Yeah.
And the network said, no, you're going to finish it, wrap it up in 6 episodes instead of 18.
Wrap it up.
That's kind of how I feel what happened to Lost in a different way, where they, the creators of that were like, we're doing this for 3 seasons. And ABC was like, oh no. Cause they like, we got a whole arc. It's going to end in 3. And they're like, no, you're doing it for 10. They're like, we don't have 10.
We don't have that content.
Yeah.
So they went through 6 or 7 and got to the end. And Kathy, my wife, was like, well, there's 6 years of my life down the drain. Like she literally said that at the last episode. I was like,
I have never been more happy at skipping a show.
Yeah, I missed Lost.
I watched it again over COVID with the kids because they hadn't seen it. And they were like, what's with the polar bear? What's with the... And we'd feel like, oh my God, the hatch. Like we were so... Yeah.
The hatch of the comic book.
We started the last season and Sullivan was like, this is stupid.
Yeah.
And we just...
Part of me was very, 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 very close to picking Party of 5 for this segment.
Yeah.
Which I love.
Yeah, we watched.
That's a different kind of guilt, I expect.
Right?
Well, a Jennifer Love Hewitt based.
Jeff Campbell's not bad either. But
yes.
So, yeah. And then Lacey Chabert comes into her own. But I will say that, like, you know, Matthew Fox.
Yeah, that's just wrong.
I was young.
So was she. That's all. That's all point.
I'm younger than you guys.
Like, really, you were not that young.
Young enough.
Anyway. All I'm going to say is, hang on to that one, Joe, for Guilty Pleasures for The Quest for Peace. Okay.
I will spin around the globe and turn back time to make it okay.
Mr. Swan, what guilty pleasure have you brought us from the world of television?
God,
this show's never going to end.
It's not.
That's okay. It's fun.
We'll shorten it in post.
I was going to talk about, part of me wanted to talk about Glee, but that kind of goes with the same sort of, it was a lot of fun. Then, like, kind of what happened to some of the people on the show and what they did, and that kind of ended. So I'm going to go with one.
And it was like High School Musical for adults. I loved it.
Right. And it was fun. Adults. But so I'm going to go with one that's far more embarrassing. Kathy works, she's a psychologist, and she works really hard.
Blaming your wife.
No, she comes home and says, I'm going to watch. And this has been forever. She's like, I just want to watch something that's, I don't want to think. I'm like, okay. So especially during the pandemic, we were watching like reality TV shows, like Bling Empire and like reality, like
Flavor, you know, of
Real
Love.
Real Estate in Beverly Hills. And like, it's so
celebrity,
it's so dumb. It's just so fun. It's almost like, it's like, guess who's going to break up with who? Like, we figured out, and they're like, I can't believe it. It's like, just sort of psych. But then, but the reality stuff gets sort of old after a while. And she's like, we want to kind of find a show. Oh, Gossip Girl. I never watched that. And Sullivan's like, literally was like, I'm in. And he just had like a bowl of popcorn. I'm like, I'm not watching that.
Yeah, you are.
Morgan Freeman's like,
he did, in fact, watch that.
Narrator. You watched Gossip Girl. Yeah.
He's not like editing the Wikipedia page for it. And
they've remade it apparently, but this is like early, like 2007, I think, somewhere around there. And it's a soap opera with it's teenagers all played by 20 something, maybe 30 year old actors. You know the bit.
Yeah.
Blake Lively, who
is Ryan Reynolds' wife,
who was, I know, which, and
Deadpool's tapping that,
I know. And she was not good as an actress in the first season. She got a lot better as the show went on. But it's these rich kids in Manhattan who are in high school, and yet they all go to nightclubs and they get served like it's no problem. And they all play these horrible stereotypes of like the rich and wealthy and the secrets they all have. And then there's like the working class family from Brooklyn who comes in, and the boy meets Serena Vanderwoodson. That's Blake Lively's character's name.
Come on.
Serena Vanderwoodson.
It's One Tree Hill on Park Avenue.
Yeah. And
Vanderwoodson,
and then there's Vanderwoodson.
Vanderwoodson built the railroads,
right? In one episode, they have there's a family that's Vanderbilt, but they can't use that name, so that it was Vanderbilt, three words. She's Vanderwoodson. The writing in the show is not
really creative. You just got to go with Vanderbilt.
The anti-hero of the group is this guy named Chuck Bass. And he always talks like this. And he's actually played by a Brit, but he does the whole New Year. He's like, I'm Chuck Bass. That's his act, like that's him. And he does that. And women swoon.
Yeah.
Girls swoon. He's a multi-cajillionaire. And the parents are all awful. And the people are all terrible to each other. And they get into problems that, like, I don't know what I want to do. How are we going to solve this? This is a real problem. And we're like, pick up a phone and call. Like, you can call him and say you're sorry. And he'd be like, you know what? You're kind of right. end of show. And that's why they didn't do it. So they all do these ridiculous things. And it's stupid. And I got sucked into it. I even mentioned it to my class, like it, like before to class started with my seniors. And they're like,
you're getting some class cred.
You're watching. No, they're in a weird way. They're like, you're watching Gossip Girl. I'm like, I can't stop. It's stupid.
They're like, now we come to the shame part of this story. Okay.
Yeah.
That's what I was waiting for. Okay.
And
excellent.
And then in the middle of it, and Sullivan's watching this, and Sullivan is a big MCU fan, and suddenly they're introducing some new character who turns around and smiles, and Sullivan and I are both like, what is the Winter Soldier doing in Gossip Girl? Because it's Sebastian Stan.
Don't do that. Chris,
that's my boy.
We're like, Chris is going to go to the bathroom and take 20 minutes.
What?
You'll
and he keeps
me.
Returning as this sort of slimy.
Chris will be in his bunk.
Chris, take a minute.
Yeah.
All right. Take all the time you need,
The
mic's going to be off for a minute. All right.
By the way, Chuck Bass was a Republican member of Congress from New Hampshire in the 90s. And that's all I can think of. This bald, older dude. Every time you talk about Chuck Bass, that guy doesn't belong on Gossip Girl.
It's just, the whole premise is there's somebody, this is at the dawn of the internet and social media. And there is a Gossip Girl narrates this, and she writes a blog to where people have, and they all flip phones. So everybody has a flip phone. Yes. It's basically like that. And they all flip phones. They'll take pictures of each other. And Gossip Girl is like, oh, look at Lonely Boy. Who's a name. It's like the poor Brooklyn kid. That's everyone's nickname for this. Oh, Lonely Boy. He's wanting to go on a date with somebody, but looks like date's got other plans. Bye now, Gossip Girl.
And Chris cares about this a little too much.
He does. He sells this.
He's invested.
He's giving us a Roadhouse level like takedown of Gossip Girl.
It's not quite,
you know.
It's just
not a takedown. It's a pain.
It's a pain. It's and then everyone's like, "Who's Gossip Girl?" And they try to figure that out.
Yeah.
And it's just so overdone and overblown and stupid. And one of the characters has got like a Polish maid named Dorota, who she like yells at and who speaks in what I assume some Hollywood writer assumes what a Polish immigrant to America, the kind of English she would speak to the.
Everything ends in ski.
Yeah. It's,
when you put on closed captions, it just reads Eastern European gobbledygook, you know? Right. Okay, thanks.
Stop. It's so much like Beverly Hills 90210.
Yeah.
And all that kind of series of shows, except that it's these wealthy kids in Manhattan. And it's addictive and it's stupid.
Well, how do you get anti-hero Chuck Bass? Like, you have to have a cool name like Dylan McKay, you know, like
Chuck Bass.
The guy played
you do when the fish is too small to keep.
He's I have women to take care of. He says, like, in his kimono with his like martini glass, and then there's like, you know, these two the hot so girls great and deshabille in the doorway of his bedroom. He's like, you know.
So they stole from Chevy Chase's character.
Colette says
Yvette. I'm trying to visualize this. I can't.
Caddyshack, but cool. What? Yeah. No. Chris, was there a particular moment in this show
where you knew you had gone wrong?
Yeah, like where you really went, I need to make better choices for myself.
About halfway
making my wife happy isn't worth anything.
What's that, Chris?
About halfway through episode one.
Second commercial break. I've committed to something.
No,
terrible. It was
a terrible mistake.
Yeah. It was just funny as hell to watch.
Yeah.
And say, okay, what ridiculous things are these guys gonna get up to? And I don't know.
I will say that I know an honestly remarkable number of women who absolutely love that show.
Mm-hmm.
I love it. And well, I've never watched it. I don't have a clue.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
I've never seen it myself, but like I heard about it so often, but not in like a guilty pleasure sort of way. Just like it's a really huge show. So I was like, okay, this actually is beloved by tens of millions of people. It's not for me. It's okay. I had no idea it was as cringy as it was.
It's cringy looking back on it now. And part of it, I think, is me being a 53-year-old man watching the show with these characters. But it's the production value slick and the writing is sometimes funny, but it's not great. It doesn't really try to be anything more than what it is. It's a nighttime soap. And it's
Millennial Dynasty.
Yeah. Kind of. And they all plot against each other and the plots are all ridiculous and they always fall apart. And who's going to get together with whom and who's going to break up this week? And oh my God, I hope they get back to get like.
So my TV choice is far afield from all this, but it's not a narrative show whatsoever. And it's something that I have watched so many times in my darkest hours when I just like needed something to soothe me, and it's still on now. It's straight up. It's Cutlery Corner. Which is basically Chris knows, it's like on the Home Shopping Network when those knife guys come on, they start selling knives for like 3 hours and like 2 o'clock in the morning. And the guy's like, we got the big Kahuna Samurai the
QVC
sword.
Is your guilty pleasure?
For like $59.99. Look at this thing. It's like a broadsword. Like
three easy payments.
Exactly. It's like Mall Ninja shit. Wait, don't answer yet. With like axe cross guard and all that. This here is the Viking Eliminator. No. Look at it. 440 custom steel. And they like show it to this camera. It like gleams
it
the entire
time. It can saw
time.
Through a 47 Chevy pickup truck. And
here's
a
steel can.
Exactly. And like, okay, we got now for you here, special, one time only ready to go for next 5 minutes, a Dale Earnhardt Bowie knife. Now look at this,
now,
you know,
the
and
peeler.
This.
I've never liked a girl well enough to give her 12 sharp knives before.
Yeah, right, exactly. It's like, yeah, this like, you can buy a whole palette of like Swiss Army knives. Like, it's just so nuts. The show dwells in the twilight zone of like when normal people are asleep and like swing shift people are at work. And so it's just like, you're only up late enough to watch a show because you've got some kind of sleep disorder or some other kind of like pretty serious, like emotional issue going on that's keeping you up from, you know, sleeping. For me, I was a young father. My daughter was up at 2 o'clock in the morning every morning. So was I. And you know what? The first one's free, kid. Once I started watching, I couldn't stop watching it. Like whenever I'm up there in the weird hours, I'm like, see if the knife show is on. All right, it's so bad, and it's still like
I'm still
like,
confused. Is this like a documentary about those people?
No, it's a commercial.
No, this is the actual
far worse.
No, it's far worse. This is the actual infomercial show where they're trying to sell me samurai swords and shit through the television.
This is George right? Foreman.
They have a name for that, and they call that Cutlery Corner.
Cutlerycorner.net streams 24 hours a day live. It's on right now. I still watch it. Okay?
Your choice is basically Oscar material compared to this one, is what we're saying.
It's not even
a show.
Have you ever spent any money? That's my next guy. Like,
that's a very fair question. I have not spent any money. I have not spent any money on it.
But kind of vicious question.
Fair but mean. Yes. That question was meant to hurt.
No, I'd be like, yeah. So how much have you spent?
Do they have your credit card?
I will
number?
Say this though. Sure. I did know a guy who spent considerable sums of money on that show. I knew a guy. That said guy also hung his purchases on his wall of his you know, single person's apartment.
It's better than using them, to be fair.
It better than using them. But like professed difficulty in getting women to come over to his place and hang out. I'm like, well, weird. Like maybe you shouldn't have the cutlery corner like hanging on your wall. That's a possibility.
No, basically, like Cutlery Corner is the commercial arm of Forged in Fire. Right?
Yes.
But with less like grown man drama.
Yeah.
Forged in Fire is great because, you know, it's meant to be a reality show, but it doesn't work that way.
No, it's guys just trying to get something working. You know, like I just want my thing to not like, blow apart. Exactly.
And when they fail, they're like, yeah, that guy deserved to win.
I didn't get enough iron. I didn't get enough iron in my smelter.
Pretty much.
Handle work.
I went with a stag handle and I should have gone with a composite. And as a result, as you can see, my knife blew apart when I hit the dummy.
Machete just wasn't in the cards.
These things happen.
Yeah. But Cutlery Corner is one of the worst things on television. And I watched it years ago. I still watch it now. I don't care who knows it. I'm burdening myself now. But it is absolutely like when you watch that show, Like now it's on all the time. So it's kind of like not, you can watch over lunch hour if you really wanted to, but like back when it was like on Home Shopping Network or whatever the heck it was, QVC or like, it was basically, I didn't know what channel it was on. I just knew like, if I was up at a certain time of night, if I looked long enough on my channels, I would find this like 3 hour block of just say knives, right? Okay, there it is. I'll just turn it on. And here are these hucksters trying to sell me this mall ninja shit, like until the sun comes up. I'm like, here
guess,
we are.
I guess
Bill, no, I have this vision of Bill in the middle, like he's exhausted. he's screaming. He's like, oh my God, I'm never going to sleep again. And he turns on and it says Blade. And he's like, 3 hours. That's the best movie ever. And next thing he knows, he's watched like 3 hours of. Knife salesmanship.
For real though, like, y'all should be aware that right now on cutlerycorner.net there is a March Madness deal with 112 blades for like $320.
Boy, this episode is over. I've got some shopping to do.
We should be glad that Bill didn't wind up in like the Mike Lindell rabbit hole and is talking to us right now about pillows.
Oh,
right, like I mean, that's pretty much the same ecosystem, right? Like,
you know what, it really is. It's very much in the same world. And you know, so this show is a guilty pleasure on multiple levels because just intrinsically on its own, it's just a very guilty pleasure, right? It's just horrible and it's just kind of crazy. But then now, especially, you know, at some point in time, it's going to wander into that territory. It's like how long is the fuse from when I started watching it to when they're going to start hitting me with some sort of really regrettable, like, you know, January 6th commemorative folding.
Oh, they're in the same deadly swamp. No question.
Right. Seriously. And then you're like, now I'm part of the problem. I'm feeding this machine right now.
They light the little lights. Don't go down to the little lights.
Yeah, exactly. So
I'm really impressed that you've managed to not spend money. I mean, if you've ever been to a flea market, you see the people who have spent money.
And they're trying to unload it at the flea market.
People who don't have it that are spending it. Yeah,
you know, Tom, to be honest with you,
600 knives on QVC.
Yeah, no, and I do love going to flea markets, and I've seen those guys trying to unload, like, you know, the big kahuna, you know, bundle. And it's like, you know, the Fires of Moria bundle. Like, oh, dude, man, this is, you're never going to unload this stuff. That's probably what's kept me. Like, there have been times I've been like, "Oh man, $12—a pretty cool looking Klingon knife."
Dude, I'm gonna get hooked on this myself.
A bat left just for $20
because exactly. I will watch, like, if I pass by QVC or whatever, and it's like the jewelry show, I'll watch that. I'll watch that for a minute.
Oh yeah, yeah. No, like,
is someone gonna buy that,
dude? You know what, Chris?
Lady in Peoria just bought that.
Yeah, right. Oh, she scored. Look at that.
You guys are basically Derek, but instead of Italian like splatter sexploitation, it's like knives and jewelry.
Pretty much. Since I'm unburdening myself, I will just admit to you now, there are times when I've gone to like whatever the hell channel that was on, I knew knives was going to be on in like 20 minutes. So I just watched what was leading into it so I could catch it like when it started. Just leave it on. Yeah. Exactly. So
you hate to be distracted and turn back.
If you look it up online, so by the way,
level, man. You are supposed to be watching Fiona.
Exactly.
Barf down your back. Like,
exactly. I don't care.
Exactly. She's been asleep. Oh, the Valhalla Scimitar's coming up. Wait a minute.
She's been asleep for hours. I'm still up.
There's a bottle. Jesus.
What's really great about it though is that the one host of the show who'd been on there for like 25 years is like when you look like when you like look it up on YouTube, I mean, this guy is routinely hammered like on the show. He's just like slurring his speech. He can't get the knives back on this thing. I mean, it's just the whole thing is just like a train wreck of the first.
I've got these knives.
Oh yeah, I've got this stainless movie. It is
don't
sharp.
Do what Donnie don't does.
You could.
It could take the hair out. Oh shit, my finger.
Exactly. Anyway, okay. So moving on. This has gone on for too long. All right, next round. Round three is listen. So, Tom, what have you brought to us from the sonic realms of guilty pleasures that we're going to talk about?
It's a hairband.
It's always a hairband with you.
No, but like, so there are hairbands that were like good back in the day and their stuff doesn't hold up. There were bands that like kind of bad back in the day and their stuff doesn't hold up. But like, I will die on the hill that this band was great back in the day and that it still holds up. And almost nobody agrees with me.
Bring it.
And the band is White Lion. And I will go
Joe!
Reddit to this day, and I look for two questions, all right, on Reddit.
Did they sing the Transformers theme song to the movie flag, or not?
Okay. And the two questions.
Bill's look of utter disappointment and shock at Joe's excitement. Tom picked White Lion. That is the entire. Joe's gone now.
Fine.
Oh God.
White Lion.
So two. All right. Two questions I will plant my flag on. It's when somebody asks, "What is the best driving song of all time?" I will be like, "White Lion, Radar Love." Absolutely better than the Golden Earring.
What?
Absolutely.
No, dude, I was going to object die on that with hill. Radar over Love. Over again. Okay, I'm going to have to listen to it because I was going to object to whatever you said with Radar Love by Golden Earring. Whatever you said.
I'm like, it's better than that version and I will die on that hill. I will also, what cover is better than the original? I will, same answer, and I will die on that hill. Every single time I start
argument. Wait, hang on. Is Radar Love by White Lion a greater cover of that song than All on the Watchtower is of All on the Watchtower? Like Jimi Hendrix versus Bob Dylan? Are you going to go that far?
Yes, I will. Absolutely.
What? How?
Because the distance between between Dylan and Hendrix is like this. The distance between Golden Earring and White Lion is like this. Again, I made all the arguments. I have made all the arguments. They're bulletproof, and I will die on the hill.
I don't know who you are.
What have you done with my friend Tom?
Yeah, seriously. Tom, if you're under duress, look in the camera and just blink yes and twice for no.
And there's a whole
catalog. Just tell us that Eddie Van Halen was overrated, and we'll know to call 911.
Exactly. Wow.
Wow.
All right, Tom. If I'm going to give this the benefit of the doubt and go, you know what? Maybe I should just get over my musical bigotry and give White Lion a try. Apart from Radar Love, mm-hmm. Where'd I start?
There's a whole huge catalog, my friend. Oh my. Start with Wait, which was the first hit single. Little Fighter, which is a song about the Rainbow Warrior, the sinking of the Rainbow Warrior, which was not a popular thing for a hair band to be doing in the 80s.
That's true.
When the Children Cry is the big ballad. Absolutely love that song.
Don't ask him why.
I mean, the hits keep coming.
Well, I'm really glad you told me these things because there's no way I'm putting them into my search history. So thank you.
By the way, the reason that I got excited was that the White Lion did the theme song to the Transformers 1986 animated film.
The Transformers theme. Oh my God, I'm embarrassed to not know that.
Nothing's gonna stand in.
There's a guilty pleasure band that I know everything about, except that they did the freaking soundtrack for this great movie.
This is what our show is about, bringing people together, even under questionable circumstances. All right, very good. I can't wait to get off this fast enough. Mr. Crenshaw, what is your guilty pleasure from the world of music?
Look, since a friend of ours posted a video in December on YouTube or Facebook, sorry.
I know what this is.
I have not spent more than 2 hours while I was awake without singing a Måneskin lyric, often in Italian.
Oh man, yes.
This band, oh my God, I shouldn't love them. They are embarrassingly like juvenile and hypersexualized. They're honestly the sexiest band in the world. Like their blonde bassist is beautiful and frequently like performs in like pasties or X's of electrical tape over her nipples. In one of the most recent videos, the lead singer Damiano David, who is like the most Italian looking man in existence, he is like Michelangelo's David. He is beautiful. The whole video is just him standing naked and singing the song with like black censorship bars over his junk. Like, They've got a song called Blah 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 on their most recent album that has the most juvenile lyrics ever. Including Kiss My Butt.
So Chris, here's my question for you about the
state of Tennessee. So they ripped off Bachman Turner Overdrive too.
But that's the thing, that they are so frigging good. They're the most eclectic band I think I've ever heard. Like they've just sucked up a little bit of everything. They've got like all of these Caribbean influences that like verge on like cultural appropriation. I don't think that guy should be singing with that accent. I really don't. I don't think he has a right to, but they make it work, and they know how to write a hook, and they've been around for like right now, like 6 years. Okay. They first appeared, they were literal buskers. They were street performers in Rome, and they got onto the Italian version of X Factor, came in second to a band that, for God's sake, it was like the Italian version of Bare Naked Ladies. I didn't get it. But then they win Eurovision with their song Ziti Buoni. They're huge. They're awesome. They're stupid. Like they've got on their last album, they've got a song that's done. It's just a punk throwback. He sings it in a stupid, stupid English accent. It works. I don't know. It works. I cannot stop listening to this band. I fly all the time, and that's where I do a lot of my music listening. And I will listen to all four of their albums one after another.
So, Chris, I really like when you talk about music, you share new bands, like your musical tastes and mine are fairly simpatico. And there are a number of bands that you brought up to my attention that I'm really grateful you did. And so when you were like popping your cork over Måneskin, right? And for the people out there, it's Maneskin, right?
Correct.
And there's like
what's the little character over the?
It's Norwegian. It's a Norwegian
diacritical.
It makes it Måneskin or something like Måneskin. That.
Almost like an umlaut.
Well, you know, if you're auto pirating software, you can find it. That's the reason why.
It means moonlight in Norwegian. The bassist, and right. Oh my God, what a great bass sound she has. These right. guys, they really are talented. The lead singer has an amazing voice. The guitarist is just goofy looking, but still sexy. And he you know what he reminds me of is Ace Frehley.
Mm. Let me just ask you something, Chris. I have never seen you enthused so much over a band that I cared less about than this one. Okay. So help me understand why it is I really could not give two flying at a rolling donut over this band, whereas so many others that you like, I am with you all the way. What am I missing with these guys? Because honestly, I'm not getting any of the love that you have for them whatsoever.
It may be that I just have a real love for glam rock and funk. Like those are two of my big and there's a lot of funk guitar.
Yeah, and there's definitely a glam aspect to it.
Oh, they're super super duper glam.
Super glam. Yeah.
And yet there's this like low key virtuosity to them. Like they're writing 80s power ballads that are kind of gorgeous.
So like, let me ask you this. NASA has determined that a planet killing asteroid is coming to Earth with a 100% certainty. And you have a chance to go to one more concert in your life. Are you going to a galactic concert or are you going to a Måneskin?
I'm going to Måneskin.
What?
He's going to
Portishead.
Because no hesitation.
Let's not kid each
None.
Other.
Because
Chris, there's no hesitation at all. I don't know who he is.
I've seen Galactic a number of times. I love Galactic. They know I love them. But
I know. You know what? That's something a Skrull would say. Is something a Skrull would say. Okay.
But I am not being impersonated. I love this band. That's and awesome. I don't care who knows.
I do love that you love them though. Seriously. Like Chris, you've been talking about them a lot. I really don't care about them, but I get joy watching how much they bring you joy. If that makes any sense. Like I know you love them so much. I'm like, I'm just glad you found a band you dig so much. It's a great thing.
This is one of the cooler things about this band. Like they're just like stealth. you know, half or close to half their songs are in Italian. They're never going to really be huge in America. But I have twice in the last 2 weeks heard them in retail establishments, in a grocery store on the, you know, the Muzak track.
Yeah.
They had Måneskin's version of Beggin', of the Four Seasons song, Beggin'.
Oh, okay.
Which is probably their most famous song in America. It's both my kids' favorite by them. And then I heard it at a local burger shop, you know, in the piped radio, not a real radio station. So they're actually, you know, getting some penetration into the weirdest ass places. I don't, it's weird.
Good but for them.
It sounds like Chris, I can't tell that joke, but Chris, so let me understand, because I missed some of this. Are they a Virginia College a cappella group?
No, believe it or not. No.
Okay.
No, they're like a hypersexualized group of Italians of various sexual orientations. Like, and they're not afraid to exploit any of them. They will exploit any of it. It's
almost like they should be put in a ship and sent out to the stars to spread humanity across the galaxy.
Basically auditory
spread Deadpool. Something.
Yeah, spread something. Exactly. Oh man. All right.
Hear these guys.
All right, cool. Joe, what regrettable music act have you brought to the conversation today?
When I was in high school, I fell in love with big band music. And from the 30s and the 40s, we're talking Glenn Miller and his orchestra, Benny Goodman, Andrew Sisters, you know, God, String of Pearls, Pennsylvania 65,000, Don't Say No to the Apple Tree, Moonlight Serenade. It's square as hell, but I love it. I love it. I love it. And I will always love it.
Would you rather see like a dramatized version of the Declaration of Independence done to Broadway music or done to swing music?
I say like let's do the Billy Joel Twyla Tharp thing and like let's bring it together.
I knew Billy Joel was going to come into it. He couldn't resist. He just couldn't.
I would love to see a story about the Declaration of Independence set to big band music.
Yeah, you know what? I think I'd listen to
little
it.
Brown jug for everybody.
Yeah. So let me ask you this though. I mean, it's square as hell, but I mean, but this music also is though seriously cool. I mean, like if you catch it in the right mode and you're in the mood, this music it does have some pretty serious staying power.
I mean, if you're Captain America, yeah.
Oh yeah,
like,
if
you've been Steve Rogers and Joe, are yeah, be yeah like
trapped
this.
In ice for 70 years, absolutely. We all
think about tapping Haley Atwell together to this music, and it's fine. But like this music, it's incredibly atmospheric. It's there's so much narrative value. To this.
Have you
I'm
ever
on
had
Team
to...
Joe here? I'm definitely. When you're in high school and you join the jazz band, swing music is what they make you play instead of real jazz.
Yeah, right.
Soft spark.
Yeah. Like, real jazz.
Yeah. But
because they're afraid they're gonna go smoke reefer and go crazy.
Nobody wants to play jazz. Watermelon Man. Get out of here.
Cigarettes. So, Joe, you'd be pleased to know that at the college that the rest of us went to, WNL, one of the big traditions is the fancy dress ball in March, and.
Yeah.
You know, we had two gymnasiums interlinked, an old one and a modern one. And the modern one would always have like, you know, a current band, you know, your Blues Traveler or the Replacements Matthews or whatever.
Yeah.
And the other, the old gym would always have a big band.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it would rock too.
And it was rocking. Like
it was
like
good stuff.
Half the people were in there.
Give me like a 9-piece band that can jump.
Yeah, right.
And I don't care. Like you can have your 3-piece guitar band. Go, get out of here. Give me the one that is there's the podiums with the name of the like the initials of the band in front on the front.
Yeah.
And like everybody is dressed up and we're doing the Foxtrot and we're doing the Lindy and we're doing there's nothing sexier. I don't care what anybody says.
I do have to say one of the
really I think any 90-year-old man would agree.
I'm right here, man. You don't have to call me names.
I think one of the cool things about this kind of music though is that you know, so much of it was performed live and these guys were just so tight as live musicians, right? I mean, they're able to just kind of just knock the stuff out out of the park again and again and again. And there was certain like a level of just sort of live performance virtuosity with these guys that you know, I don't know if other music has really matched it, but it's
these were guys getting laid in horn rim glasses. Okay,
this is true.
My grandmother's brother was a guy by the name of Gene Pace, and he was in a Navy band called the Kingfishers, and he played clarinet, and he was in a big band for years and years. And I've got a picture of the big band that he was in. And I look at these guys, and they're all in their early 20s from, you know, like the 1940s or whatever. And like, they just like, they ooze this like sensuality that is so different from what we have now. You know what I mean? And like, there was like, somehow class was meeting with just desire. And it was somehow classy and sexy and all at the same time, and it speaks to me on a visceral level.
No, have you ever had to really defend it though? Like have you ever people coming at you really, really seriously, like this music is terrible? Why would you ever do this?
I've been high school. People are like, what the hell?
That it was terrible so much as you're square. Right? I mean, like,
okay,
you know what I mean? Like Uma Thurman was drawing me in the air with her fingers. And like, you know, my buddies who were listening to Nirvana and Pearl Jam were like, what's the matter with you? And I was like, I don't know. I'm awesome. And, you know, you just can't handle it.
Yeah.
So my grandmother had a tape set of like World War II music when I was like, I don't know, 11, 12, 13 years old. And she played it when I would sit around at her house because I was being babysat, and just absolutely fell in love with the rhythm and the melody and the just the stories that were told and the lyrics and all of it. And I've never gone away from it.
You know, it was a really unexpected deep dive I had into that kind of music. When I was playing the video game Fallout 4, So Fallout 4 is a post-apocalyptic video game. It takes place like in an alternate future of an alternate past, right? Where like there's a full blown, like George Jetson level scientific, like science fiction starts happening by the 50s. There's a total nuclear war, but he goes into bunkers and everything. And so you kind of come out in this wrecked world of the remains of a 1950s that could have been, right? And that sort of thing. But
still a lot of neon around.
Okay. A lot of holders but the point is you've got like this like, you know, wrist radio, you're going along and you listen to music that's being piped through the world. And a lot of it is like old big band kind of stuff, and then modern stuff they recorded in that big band style. And I remember I would just listen to that music. Like I just dug those tunes, and like they're just a lot of fun to listen to. And I was like, you know what, it's 2018 or whatever, and here I am listening to big band on my PlayStation.
It's timeless
thing.
In the sense that like it was good stuff, but like you also get like back in the 90s there was, I think it was what was it, like Squirrel Nut Zippers or some of these other Jackrabbits, like, you know, some of
Cherry Pop and Daddies.
Yeah, Cherry Pop and Daddies, who like brought this like the Zoot Suit and, you know.
Yeah. Zoot Suit, right?
Brian Seltzer. Brian Seltzer Orchestra.
For six months. That happened for 6 months.
Absolutely.
And it was a thing, right? Yeah. Where people were like, oh man.
Yeah, it's a good time.
Granddad got some work done.
But that really wasn't. I don't know. I don't think I put that stuff in the same class. Like my grandmother, Joe, loved Lawrence Welk, and so I listened that's
Tiny
big band stuff.
Is a different thing.
I wouldn't put Lawrence Welk in there, Chris.
You're gonna say that's closer to Cherry Pop and Daddies than Lawrence Welk. I'd have to disagree.
Well, let me do this.
I just think you should leave Welk out of it. I mean,
absolutely
the
a
spectrum.
Place for Lawrence Welk, but that's like the 800 Club version of big band music. Okay, like big band music dripped
whiter than I am, which is
dripped.
But all big band music is white as can be. I mean,
yes and no.
If you pull up, there's a movie, Stormy Weather. 1943, there's a clip that hit the internet.
Talking about
years
the tap
ago.
Dancers, Chris.
It's the Nicholas Brothers. It's got Cab Calloway is conducting the band. And I know nothing about the movie. I've just seen this clip and it's about 6 minutes long. I don't know what these guys were doing,
on
what
stairs.
The music's amazing. It's all big band stuff, and it's these tap dancers who are tapping on tables up on the instruments, and they're doing things that I'm like, it hurts watching.
The
multiple, like they'll leap and then split, and somebody will jump over, and the brother will jump over him and split, and they continue doing this down like that. How, and they get up and continue doing another routine, and the camera doesn't break, and it's big band music. And I don't think I'm wrong. I think these guys, are.
I would not be surprised with the big band scene, and I would have to look into it. So I could be totally wrong here, but like, I mean, there was I would not be surprised if that was an area of the arts where there was a lot of racial barriers being kind of totally disregarded by the artists, you know.
And that was back when like you didn't play jazz because that was black people music,
right?
Ella Fitzgerald was singing with these guys,
yeah.
And there was a lot exceptions. Of crossover, like
there absolutely were exceptions.
Go watch the Blues Brothers again and watch Cab Calloway. No, I'm not even kidding. Like, now watch Cab Calloway bring scat and bring, like, there's a, and when he goes, have their big final show at the Palace Theater at Lake Wazapamani, and Cab Calloway's got to burn time because the guys haven't shown up yet, what does he do? It's a big band show he does when he does Minnie the Moocher. That's big band stuff.
Right? It is really compelling. It's compelling stuff. It's hard to not just fall in love.
And you know,
but that's in the context of a movie about soul music. I mean,
soul comes right from big band. It's there's a direct line there from, I'm sorry, but from like Upper Harlem 1910 jazz, like the roots of jazz and ragtime, and through big band. A lot of the guys, the sax, the clarinet, the trumpet, the trombone, these were all black guys in these big bands playing for Glenn, playing for Benny Goodman. Like, their bands were full.
Duke Ellington. I mean, yeah, you got.
Take the A Train, man.
Yeah. I mean, Chris, you're absolutely right that, yeah, there was huge racial disparity. I mean, hell, there wasn't rock and roll, right?
Right.
I think.
I'll never forget the time my dad tried to tell me, like, for years. He was convinced that rock and roll was invented by a white guy. I'm like, Dad, I don't think that's true. No.
Elvis invented rock.
They invented rock and roll. I'm like, Dad, that is just not true.
Jimi Hendrix's rhythm section was not white.
Yeah, exactly. Like, Dad, you don't know what you're talking about, man. I'm telling you, you just don't know. So
Chuck Berry played backup for Elvis. But anyway, all that being said is that there are only so many American art forms. Jazz absolutely is one. And big band, to me, swing music is part of that narrative.
No, I dig it. So Mr. Swan, what regrettable music have you brought to this? It better be more regrettable than big band, because Joe kind of softballed on us. I'm gonna be honest with you here.
I was like Casey Kasem, top 40 all the time.
Long distance dedication.
And I mean, I went to boarding school, and then got people in the dorm. Like, some of the seniors are like, listen to this new band, REM. And I was like, I don't get it. when I got to college, I got it. But if I was like,
everybody, you had to.
It was kind of right. Yeah. You were.
Everybody.
And,
seriously. You could not go to school in the South.
No, you're not going to school. I'm like,
and
who is this RAM?
Yeah,
that's garbage.
that's Chris in the corner.
I'm in the spotlight.
He's losing
his credibility. So no, So my taste in music is often it's kind of eclectic, but in many ways it's very, very conventional. And I went, when I first started teaching high school, I was the advisor for student council. And every once in a while, especially how long ago it was, you would get these, occasionally you would get demos, rarely, but you get music demos. Like, I got a five song CD demo from this band. This was in like 2001. It's this new band out of California. They're kind of neo-funk. you're gonna, it's real, and pop and rock, it's really good. You're gonna really love this. And I listened to the first song, I was like, what is this? And tossed it and said, no. That, and then years later, I heard some of those songs on the radio and was like, these aren't bad. And then realized what they are, because what I'd gotten mailed was a five track demo for Songs from Jane by Maroon 5. and they were trying to drum up business. Yeah. I don't think they were going to like fly the band out to the schools. And then my wife and a bunch of her girlfriends were going to go to Maroon 5 concert and an extra ticket. And so I became the driver and said, yeah, I'll go. Sure. Mm-hmm. And went, and I was amazed at how many of the songs I knew and how rhythmic they are and how have their earworms, right? But every song they played, I'm like, oh, I know that one. Like, I don't know the name of it, but I know that song. And they were fun and they were theatrical. And, you know, Adam Levine, you know, he's all tatted up. He's like this sort of stereotypical.
He's like a human sticker book guy.
Yeah.
Like, it looks like a child got Adam with a tattoo gun.
Yes. And he's, you know, he's married to a model. And then recently he got caught like sexting with someone, and you're like, why?
Seriously, like,
come on. Your wife's name is Bahati. Seriously, that's her name. And she's gorgeous. You have children with her.
Yeah, but Chris, if you put that in a novel of yours, man, your editor would be like, Mr. Swan, we are talking. Now come here.
this is not realistic. But no, and I know they played the Super Bowl halftime show a while ago. And I mean, once Prince did it, like everyone else would just be like out, like just drop.
Pretty much. Yeah.
But they did it and they got completely, they got completely slammed. And like, who are these guys who think that they're like doing funk and neo soul? Like this is,
they've got moves like Jagger.
Yeah. I know. And it's cheesy. But it comes on the radio, and I'll say, like, sugar. They had some video for their song Sugar where they went around LA and to all these weddings. And the people having the wedding receptions, they didn't know it. But there's this curtain over where the band's gonna come in. And they're like, where are these video cameras being set? Why are these cameras all being set up? And suddenly they would pull the curtain down, and there's Adam Levine and Maroon 5, and the looks on the faces of the brides, and then eventually the groom, and the people are like, oh my God.
Eventually the grooms.
It's there. Yeah. They're like,
slightly less enthusiastic.
Yeah.
They were like, who are these guys? And
poor groomsmen.
The women all knew exactly who they were.
Yeah.
Of course they did.
And right. And I remember like watching, I was like, oh, and even if it's a video, it's all completely fake. I don't care. The idea of these guys, like, we're going to go do this, like driving around. I was like, oh, that's fun. And they're cheesy and their lyrics, like, you know, there's nothing, they're not groundbreaking, but Adam Levine's got a hell of a vocal range. The guy's got a falsetto that makes me, you know.
Chris, if you were somehow teleported to a Maroon 5 concert and suddenly Levine pulled you up on stage, like, I want to introduce the whole world to our very biggest
dirty
fan,
dancing,
Christopher dirty dancing, Swan.
In the dark with Chris Swan.
When you think Maroon 5, I want you to think of this man. Like, what is the number? What's the financial figure you would want to offer up to the universe to undo this particular turn of events?
I don't think that I have enough earning potential in my lifetime, probably, to come up with a number. You know, if they're going to dedicate a song to me, that's what I was afraid. You're going to like, what song? I was like, oh, Jesus.
We're going to call this Swan Song with two N's.
It ain't going to be moves like Jagger, because that is an earworm that does bug the hell out of me. But like, you know, Payphone, Cold Animals. But no, they're fun. And they put on a hell of a show. They had enough showmanship. And yeah, it's mostly Adam Levine, but the other guys in the band. But that's one of those bands was like Adam Levine, and then like, oh yeah, everybody.
Yeah,
the ones that nobody knows
their name.
Couldn't be. Right. Yeah, you couldn't name them at all. Put a gun to your dog's head. You're like, I can't do it.
Yeah, there's nothing completely original, or I don't think. But no, they're just fun.
So my guilty pleasure for music is way more disappointing to myself, frankly, because it is a relatively new selection. You know, when I was growing up, I, like when I was a teenager, you know, I leaned heavy into, like, you know, when heavy metal got big, I was like, oh, I'm into this in a huge way. You know, really hard rock, I was totally into. I caught endless amounts of Static for it when I was in college, like bringing, like, your, like,
sticks, you
know,
again.
No, I'm not gonna do sticks, trust me.
No more Mr. Roboto.
No. Dude, you will wish I mentioned sticks, okay? But I've always loved heavy metal, I've always loved really hard rock, you know. I just love, just, you know, and like when just when grunge and alternative rock kind of really got going, I was like, it was great, I really enjoyed it, but like I would always like something a little heavier, you know, that sort of thing. And growing up, the station I listened to in the Lehigh Valley was WZZO Z95, which is, like, you know, their link. And so my current radio station is that analog. It's WRAT, the Rat, down the Jersey Shore. And they always play all this, like, new metal, hard alternative stuff that, like, and I'm so old now, like, I don't know any of these bands at all, right? So it's all just like this endless parade of bands I've never heard of before, don't know who they are.
I recognize that power chord, though.
Right? I'm in my car driving home one day, and this song comes on, like, halfway through, and I'm like, this sounds all right, I can get with this. Like, just going to do-do-do-do-do. And I was like, right on. Like, this song kicks ass, man. What is it? And, like, that was Nickelback with San Quentin. I'm like, son of a bitch, are you kidding me?
I almost picked Nickelback.
I almost took my car off the road. I couldn't believe I got catfished and listened to a Nickelback song. I was like, God damn it. Like,
yeah, you're guilty.
I will never be able to take that back. That moment will be with me forever. Like me and God and you guys all know this now. And it's like, it hurts so hard. I could not believe. And you know, it's funny. And I was like, okay, you know what? I was driving, I was kind of distracted. Like, maybe there's something to the song. Maybe I just need to give them a break, because it's so fashionable to hate on Nickelback. Like, maybe I listened to it this morning and I'm like, Bill Coffin, I'm disappointed in you. Like, you should have known better. This song is so empty and fake and hollow. And I was looking up, like, why do people dislike Nickelback?
Photograph.
Dude, man, I came across this fantastic academic paper. It's so good.
I think I might have seen this.
Dude, it is a 25 long peer-reviewed paper called Hypocritical Bullshit Performed Through Gritted Teeth. Authenticity Discourses in Nickelback's Album Reviews in Finnish Media by Sally Antonin, University of Eastern Finland. And for 25 pages,
that's just perfect.
She breaks down with surgical accuracy why Nickelback is worthy of no Finn's time. And it's, oh my God. Like, it's like, I read this, and I'm sorry.
But you, like, gotta send me a link to that.
No, yeah, I'll send you a link to the show notes. It is really fantastic reading. But I'm reading this and I'm like, I just kept thinking to myself at the wheel driving right out of the song, like, I have lost all credibility with myself. Like, Bill, it'll take
you years. Can see yourself getting smaller and smaller.
Yes, like, it's gonna take years to get the stink off me on this one. So,
Bill, there was an app in Facebook that you used to be able to, like, which of your friends likes Nickelback? like them. And I got lit up, and one of my friends is like, Swan. I'm like, it was like a weak moment in 1999. They're like,
the algorithm is messed
like.
Up.
It wasn't like you listened to Photograph once, like, this isn't a bad song. Like, you like actively pursued, like, I considered taking all of my social media down.
I mean, you'd have to.
I would have sooner admitted that I still listen to the Spin Doctors and walk around going, yeah, I'm a Nickelback fan, right? But it turns out,
Two Princes
I
is a good song.
Right?
I saw them live at UNH back. Anyway.
Yeah, me too.
We did too.
Yeah. Not at UNH.
I saw them in all his armpit hair, and yes, I remember that too.
Such is my shame. All right. So, like, we've gone on for a rather long period of time. We've got two more rounds to go. I want to pause and we'll reconvene next week.
Moments of Truth is hosted by Bill Coffin, Chris Crenshaw, Tom Hespos, and Joe Pace. This podcast is edited by Derek Eisenhart. The Moments of Truth theme is a mashup of The Claremont by Flash Fluherty and a little help from a Texas Instruments Speak and Spell. For more Moments of Truth, be sure to subscribe to this show wherever you get your favorite podcasts, or check us out on YouTube or at momentsoftruth.show. And now, a little crass commercialism. Thanks for listening.
3, 2, 1. Dollars.
When Andy Chester loses his young wife Lisa to breast cancer, he finds himself on a grief journey with no certain destination. As he confronts his greatest fears about death, Andy must reckon with the possibility that there may be no life after Lisa. Read After Lisa, the new novel by best-selling author Joe Pace, available now on Amazon and wherever fine books are sold.
Susie Faulkner has fought against the darkness her whole life, but will her skills be enough against her evil equal? Never Back Down, number 3 in the Faulkner Family Thriller Series by Christopher Swan, available now.
Experience 53 of the greatest weird fiction short stories ever published by Mary Shelley, H.P. Lovecraft, Gray Lespina, Ambrose Bierce, and many more in Tales from the Outer Canon, a new weird fiction anthology edited by Bill Coffin. Get Tales from the Outer Canon today on Amazon or for free on archive.org. The Yellow King.